Welcome to Making It Small in Music with Barker and Broski. I am Chris Broski, and I'm a very small musician, but one day I hope to grow up to be a medium musician. I wouldn't want to be a big musician. I think that would it all go to my head, and I just, you know, that never ends well.
And I'm Mike Snyder Barker. I'm a big musician in that in width, not popularity. And you know, one thing I really like about making it small in music is the intimate audiences, and the ability to just kind of connect with people. Because, you know, when you're out there and the lights are blaring in your eyes and you can't see the crowd, well, not that I've ever experienced that, but I imagine it would be tough.
Well, how would you know if you can't see them? You know,
and if I've never experienced it.
So this week, our special guest is Memphis Hawk. Steve, I don't know, what should we call you? What would you like? Your stage name, your real name? What do you like?
No, I think Steve is good. I think we're all friends here. So we'll go with Steve. But yes, I do perform and record and sign autographs under the name Memphis Hawk.
It's a great stage name. I really dig it. It's like, wow, was that even available? Have you Googled that? Are there other Memphis Hawks out there?
I'm it. If you Google Memphis Hawk, there's one other person. He's a rapper who goes by Hawk Memphis. Yeah, it's just weird. But he's a rapper. You would never confuse him for me or I for him. And it just flips. But yeah, Memphis Hawk was available when I went looking for it.
Wow, struck gold.
So the name didn't come to you naturally. You just kind of looked, you know, Memphis Eagle. You know, Toledo dog.
Well, you know, I think I always wanted to perform and record under a pseudonym. I think, I don't know, you could probably dig into it psychologically with trying to separate yourself from the art. So that people, you know, make fun of you. It's like, well, that's not me. That's this character I play. So that may or may not be true, but so I knew early on, I wanted to record under a different name and perform under that name. And the reason I guess I went with Memphis Hawk was it's kind of twofold. I think it was, I don't know if it was Robert Johnson or one of the old blues guys was talking about the city of Memphis, and that Memphis kind of represented a nirvana, so to speak, for blues musicians, and that you knew if you got to Memphis, you made it. But a lot of guys never got to Memphis, and that was okay though, because they were always on their way to Memphis, but if they ever got there, they knew they were really had arrived. And so I really loved the idea that Memphis kind of represented that kind of spiritual musical place to these musicians.
Yeah, and that's then the horizon.
Yeah. And then the name Hawk just came from some Native American spiritual stuff that I really dug. Kind of the ability that they believe that since hawks, they glide on the wind at the altitudes they do, they have this ability to see everything beneath them. And so I always aspired to that, to be able to have a point of view that took into everything, not just a very narrow scope, but really took everything into consideration when, you know, in my everyday thinking, in my music, in my writing, so, you know, artistically and otherwise. And so they just kind of came together kind of naturally. And like you said, it was no one else had come up with the name yet.
Yeah, yoink, grab that. It's glorious. And it really fits your music, I think, really well. It's really bluesy and rocky. And it's, I love it. I'm a fan.
Oh, thank you.
Rocky and Bullwinkle.
And anyhow.
So it's great to talk to you. I've only interacted with you a few, you know, several times on the internet open mic gig. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're somebody I've only seen on a screen, and it's going to be good really to hear your story and find out what you're about.
You know what? Me too. I have never met Steve in real life.
Oh.
I know, you know, Dan and some of the other guys that mm-hmm. from the open mic that I have met in real life. So I'm pretty sure you're real.
I'm as real as can be. Yeah, we're just a couple degrees away from each other. And it's funny because I have met Chad now live. We've come together at a couple of, I think he and I have both gone to see Tom play, and we just ran into each other. And so, yeah, and I knew Dan is the one who actually invited me to come onto the open mic to play. So yeah, it is nice having an extended conversation with both of you. Well, yeah, that too, but you know, just to kind of, you know, talk about stuff that we like to talk about, rather than the little 30-second, you know, okay, let's talk about stuff and then move on real quick. So it's nice to have this extended conversation.
It is. You know what? I've been trying to get better at podcasting. So this week I watched Joe Rogan talked to Jewel.
Oh.
3 hours and 40 minutes they talked.
Wow.
It was nuts. And I recommend it. Jewel is a fascinating person, but I don't think we're quite there. I think we're going to shoot for 2 hours. We're going to have a conversation, talk about whatever comes up and whatever we want to talk about. And okay. That is one thing I like. I mean, so many musicians, you hear interviews and it's the same questions over and over. And I love this format where you could just dig in. You take all the time you want and talk about whatever you want.
Ask people shoe size, you know, what, mm-hmm. what hair products they use.
You know, what's your mother's maiden name and your first pet?
I'm an open book. You want all my passwords, huh?
Yeah, and the last yes. 4 of your social security number.
You know, just to get to know you. Anyhow, you know what? The first thing I want to ask that I've been really interested in finding out is you are so prolific. You just crank out quality albums. What is your, I assume you have a home recording studio?
I record on, I record tracks directly onto an app on an iPad, and then I upload those to Cubase, and that is where I do my mixing, and that's where I do most of my work. So the nice thing about the doing it on a tablet is I'm mobile. Last year, I think Matthew Schmidt, I was able to record an album for him in a church. I record my own stuff just wherever I feel inspired to do it, and then I bring it down to my basement. In my quasi home studio where I've got my instruments and everything. And I upload it there and I do all my mixing right there in my basement.
It sounds fantastic. I've tried doing it before and it stresses me out. It's so much work.
Oh, it is. You know, I purposely record the last three albums I've recorded in the spring. I don't listen to them until fall. I listen to them and I hate them. And I stop listening to them again and I stop working on them again till the next winter. And that's really when I do 90% of the work. And I think it's because anyone who records on their own and then produces themselves, you have to take time to take that hat off. So you're a musician at first, but if you try to be a musician and a producer at the same time, it results in you thinking you've wasted your entire life because you hate everything you do. You need that space. You need the space to put on the producer hat. And you listen to things with a new set of ears, and it is so much better because you realize, you know what? It's not all crap. It's only 80% crap. But 20% of it, it's not so bad. And then you
That's awesome. Yeah, because I was so frustrated, you know, trying to be an artist and a performer and now a producer. And it's like they're all pulling me different directions. I love this. You just take a break. You can shift gears. Come back to it from
I think you have to. I've tried mixing and producing right after recording, and it never works. I'm disgusted with myself. But then I give myself a break and I come back and I hear things differently. And I think because you stop remembering what you were trying to do. And now what you have, what's in front of you is what you actually did do. And you can really come away and say, because you had a plan doesn't mean you should stick with that plan. And I think as an artist, you are hooked to that. You are handcuffed to that plan. You don't know how to say, you know what? I don't always have not all of these ideas are good ideas. And sometimes you trip over good ideas and there's happy accidents. And there's just, you know, you play songs for friends and they come back and they point stuff out to you. And, you know, by giving yourself that space, you're no longer, you no longer think of those songs as children that you're afraid of killing. You understand that, okay, it's art, it's malleable. It's not concrete. It's not in concrete. Art doesn't have to be in concrete. When we put it in concrete, I think we really limit what we're doing.
It becomes stagnant in concrete.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know what? It's like, maybe it is like people. Like, you know, if you got a fresh person right out of the oven, you'd be like, well, I can't be friends with this person. All they do is cry and poop.
And
you know?
Craps in his pants. Exactly.
Exactly. This person is not done yet. Put them back. and, you know, I guess it is like growth. You know, you have a maturity like a person or I don't know, a cheese, whatever. You know, there's a there are steps to the creative process. And like, do you is writing part of your recording, or do you do a whole lot of writing separate and then pull things out as you record, or just you get an idea for a song and you write it right to digital?
So I almost all of it I write and I work on up till about 90%. Now, I guess that's all right. So that's not, if we're just talking about lyrics, melody, song structure, that is 90% done before recording. But when I get to recording is when I get to experiment with this last album, particularly the space between two thoughts, because I played all the instruments on there. Where in before I used to, I would have a couple other friends play on the albums parts in here. And this was the first album where I played the whole thing. So I really got to experiment with, you know, different parts that I wasn't thinking about when I was writing the songs. And there's some, you know, some really neat stuff that kind of comes out of those experimentations. And then the last two albums I've had all done, except for both times I finished what I thought was the record. And then I thought, I'm missing an element. I'm missing an ingredient. You know, when you taste something and it's not quite, there's a spice you didn't put in the sauce.
Right.
And so both the last two albums, I had that and I wrote a new song basically after everything else was recorded and written
to fill in that gap.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. And so the last two albums, I had two songs like that and they came out exactly what I needed. And so it was like very happy stuff that it's like, that comes out of desperation. Both songs, I think the vocals for both songs were one take piece. I only sang them one time and I was done. And usually I'm kind of, you know, I get a little weird with that, but both those times it was like, nope, it said exactly what I wanted it to say, and I moved on, and it was what I wanted them to be. So, but I do most of the work, especially when it comes to the lyrics, the structure of the song, the chord progressions.
It's all on paper.
Yeah, you know? Well, yeah, it's either on paper. Yeah, definitely going into recording, I've got 90% of it in my head or out in the world created, and that's a matter of putting it all together.
You know, I like how you leave room. You know, that 10% for that extra creativity, because, you know, you do get inspired by your own songs sometimes. And there's like, it's like the icing on the cake, or even the sprinkles on the icing on the cake.
Absolutely. I'm not a natural anything. You know, I'm not a
jack of all trades.
Yeah. So. I'm not a natural guitarist. I'm not a natural piano player. So it really is a lot of fun experimenting in those categories. So the lyrics are, to me, are the most stressful part, because that's what I've been doing the longest. And at some point someone paid me a compliment very early on and it put it in my head. Now every song, every lyric has to now be better than the last one. Otherwise I'm a failure. And so I really
finds
get stressed
you
out.
Who
it
you
takes
are
me a long
now.
Time to write words. But since I'm not a natural guitar player or piano player, or, you know, even bass, that stuff is fun for me because I can experiment with it. I have a lot of fun and I don't worry too much about it, because I improv. If I like it, I keep it. If I don't, I hit delete. And if there's parts of it I did like, I remember that and I work those in again. And it's a lot of fun for me. It's much less stressful than the word part of it.
Because your expectations are lower. You can have fun with it.
The bar is lower. And exactly. And it's just like, you know what? I'm gonna throw this down. And if I like it, great. And if I don't, no one else heard it. And I can just, you know, and that's pretty much it.
Well, that is such a good, I mean, recording by yourself. I mean, I know I've tried it, and I already talked about how frustrating it is just sort to have to do everything. But also I found it's hard for me. Maybe it's just my ADHD, but it's hard for me to get motivated if it's just me, because I don't have to do it. You know, I'll do it tomorrow or whatever. And that's why, you know, Mike writes a lot of the lyrics for us, and we collaborate, and then we go to a third party studio. And to me, that gives me the structure that I need to do it, but it is at the cost of flexibility. You know, I can't go back in later and be like, oh, you know what? Well, actually, I do go back in layer it. So we have to redo everything.
You have reams of notes.
Oh, my gosh. No,
Where did all these songs go? I deleted them.
Nathan,
we're starting to
delete our albums again.
Have you guys ever heard that story? There's a somewhat famous story about Brian Eno. If you're familiar with Brian Eno.
Oh, yeah.
It's a producer. He produced, and this is a story about a song called Where the Streets Have No Name by U2.
U2.
Oh, yeah.
You may have been familiar with the band there. Small
I've
Irish
heard
band.
Of them, yes. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So they had recorded this song. They had like 80 tracks of different guitar parts and keyboard parts. And it was just very complicated. And the band left for the night. And Brian Eno had put every track back. This was analog. So he put every track into active record mode and was about to hit the record button on the whole board. And like Danny Lenoir, his partner's producing partner, had to come in and like hold him back from hitting the record button. Cause Brian Eno had just come to the point where it was just a mess to his ears.
Too much.
He had gone nuts and he was about to record over and say, you know, he was just because he couldn't. Now he said later in interviews, he said, well, it was just going to be easier to rebuild it from scratch because at that point it had been simplified. It's much easier to build from scratch than try to put together 105 broken pieces, which there's merit to that argument too. But yeah, Where the Streets Have No Name was almost deleted.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh my gosh.
So have you ever actually deleted a song that you worked on? Like scratched it entirely?
Yeah. You're the whole technical,
shebang.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, you know what? I don't think I've ever gotten that far. Usually there's a couple, I don't know how you guys write. There's some people that write 100 songs and then pick 12. Okay. And that's how they work. They just record, they write. And then they figure out, okay, what are the ones that work best? Which ones do I like? Which ones do I know? I usually don't get that way. I know whether a song is going in the right direction or not.
Early
about
on.
at least the halfway mark.
Yeah.
And I usually, and if I get to the point where I've got a song and I know it's not going anywhere, the melody's boring, the something to something to something, whatever it might be, I usually start just kind of poaching the song, the parts I like, and ditching the rest. And so I never
recycle that for later.
Absolutely. I take the parts I like. I don't end up with, I don't write 25 songs for a 12 song album. I usually write between 12, 13, 14 songs, get to completion, and I have my album. But I don't usually get to the point where I've finished that many songs. I have in the past for songwriting exercises, just wrote a song a week or something for like,
I've been wanting
months.
To do that, you know, just to really kind of hone the craft.
Last
it sounds
year
like
I joined
a lot of work.
I joined the February album writing month where you write a song a day and post it on this site. I made it about halfway, and I was so new to playing guitar that I really couldn't keep up, and it really wasn't sounding very good. One time I wrote this really short piece that I think all the lyrics were, I didn't have time to write a song today, and I put some music to it.
Hey, it's better to write something than nothing.
Yeah.
You know? And that's why, like, it's interesting you bring that up, because it's like, how do we write? And I think Mike and I, he has got like a telephone book full of lyrics. He just writes lyrics. And I just write music. I have a folder on my computer. I call it Bucket. It's my bucket of music. And just when I'm noodling around on the guitar and I play something interesting, I'll record it or I'll put it in tab or something like that. And I throw it in the bucket. And then periodically what'll happen is we'll just see which ones match up, or I'll write something based on some lyrics he likes, or Mike will write some lyrics based on some of the music that I like. So I don't think we write a lot of songs, but we do write a lot of pieces of songs. Yeah. And then hopefully we bring them together for the album. For something that makes sense. But the other thing we do, which is hard, which is like pulling teeth, is we decided for or we didn't decide, it just sort of happened, that we were writing this extended storyline. And now
we're I remember you guys talking about that. Yeah.
We are on this train, you know, and now we have to bring the storyline into the station. And it is challenging because you just can't, oh, let's write a fun song. No, we have a plot and we have characters and they have to do certain things. And we really have to write the music and lyrics around it. And it is challenging and I like it, but it is not as fun.
And the next piece we have to write is wrapping up all the storylines. Just
so hard
to a conclusion.
I know how George R.R. Martin feels now.
You know that. So I spent some time writing with a partner, a gentleman named Doug Bowen. He's a longtime collaborator and my friend. We go back almost 30 years, and back in 2013 or 14, he approached me and said, you know what, we've always done stuff together, we've been in bands together, let's write an album together. And so we started doing that, and he is an excellent guitar player, songwriting machine. He could put together these vocal sections that are just beautiful to your ear. And so we started writing together, and the jobs we assumed were he was working on the music and I was working on the lyrics and the melodies. And quite often he would bring to me almost complete songs with no melody, and basically say,
just an instrumental
thought. Basically this is with very obvious verse and, you know, chorus, right. And there was structure there. And he would say, you know, I was thinking about this word or this phrase or this person or this story. What can you do with that? And I loved it because it put me in a box and it forced me to get really creative. And I did, I think, some of the best work I've ever done in that situation, because I was forced to, I was given a structure and I had to be creative, but I only had this much room to do it in. And I wanted to incorporate what he was feeling when he wrote it. And we wrote 16 songs in 5 weeks. And wow. And it was just, he would every 5 days, he would email me a song or text me a song and I would start to work on it. And it just all came together. And it was just this amazing project that we worked on. And most of the credit definitely goes to Doug, because he's the kind of guitar player that plays chords that I can't even map out on a piece of paper. You know, these crazy
guitarist jazz after my own heart.
Yeah, exactly. So these crazy jazz chords and everything else, but it made for the ability. So it put me in a space where I could come up with very creative melodies, because he was giving me this amazing platform. And really, the success from any of those songs, I think, really start with him just building a foundation that any lyricist would love to come in on and put down words on top of that.
Man, you're selling this hard. What album is that? Is this on Spotify? Can I listen
to
it?
Yeah, it's called, it was something we did back, was just a self-produced album called Under the Broom Tree. The band name was Aberrant Way, Aberrantway, which is this great experiment that we put together. And it was just like, some of the songs came out great. Other ones they're okay, but it was just a really fun experience. We put together a band and played for about 15, 16 months, you know, around town, got out there into bars and, you know, just had a lot of fun doing it.
It sounds really cool. I want to have a listen.
It was a great experience. Yeah.
When it clicks like that, it's so nice, because I've been trying to write more songs on my own, but it is one of those things. It's like when you can write a song about anything you want, what do you do? You know, it's hard to find somewhere to start and to have a collaborator, you know, that has ideas. Mike's lyrics, I could just go through them and it's just, I'm like a kid in the candy store. Oh, this looks fun. And then you start thinking about what kind of music would go with these kind of words. It's great.
The words just come to me. I don't sit down looking for them. I don't know. Is that kind of how it works for you?
Oh no, I have to look for them. I have to find them. I mean,
thesaurus.
I get phrases that pop into my mind. I get usually songs for me start with a turn of phrase or some little thing that makes me think, And I think, well, if I'm saying that, then maybe somebody else will too. And so I'll take that turn of phrase and I'll go from there. But that's when it starts to get difficult for me, because I become a perfectionist with the words, and then it doesn't, I need to say, you know, I think anytime, this probably goes for all songwriters, is when you're done with a song isn't when the song's finished. It's when you've come to terms with what the song is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of how it is.
It's a process of discovery, really. Yeah. It's not, you know, piling things on. It's finding what is this song meant to be.
Mm-hmm. So, but then sometimes it does all happen at once, though. Sometimes you just can't. It's very unpredictable.
Wait, what you're saying is your songs actually have to mean something? Like, the
meaning is
that story.
That's the listener's job.
Yeah, everyone. So for me, I mean, I definitely like ear candy as much as the next person.
Yeah.
But I typically figure, you know what, if I can get someone to listen to me for 4.5 minutes, I want to try to say something. It doesn't have to be profound. It doesn't have to be heaven and hell. And it doesn't have to be love and hate. I mean, it could be, you know, something small, but I want to, if I can get your ear for a few minutes, I figure it's a songwriter's job to say something, you know? And so I hope every song that I write says something to somebody. And if it makes you think really deeply, that's wonderful. And, you know, and if you just got something out of it in that moment, that's great too. You don't have to get what I meant. You can put your own importance on it. Even for me, I can write a song and a year later, I'll think, I don't think that song was about what I thought it was. I think it's about this other thing. And
I've gone back and been like, you know what? And then I realized how clever I was and I didn't even realize it. It's like, wow, there's another layer here I hadn't even thought of.
You know, talking about being clever, one of the starts I find to writing lyrics is when I mishear something. You guys have maybe had this.
Oh, yeah. You're
hearing a lyric, you mishear it and think, damn, that was clever. And then you find out later when you're learning the lyrics, they didn't say that. And you're thinking, and mine like, now.
That's mine. Oh, yeah.
I have absolutely done that.
Very cool.
I don't think I've officially done it, but I've definitely done it in my mind. It's like, oh, I should write a song that says that. That's way better than what they said the lyrics were anyway.
I remember I was listening to this one song and I thought they said something about something about hearts being paper planes and flying too close to like flames or something. And I thought,
ooh, that's great.
That's really good. And then I listened to it again and I thought, and it's like, okay, they didn't say that at all. I had misheard some of the rhyming words and I thought, well, now I'm saying that.
that's a great metaphor.
Who do you even credit for that? You can't credit anyone. It's just the universe just handed you something. You know, you got to run with it at that point. I think Quincy Jones said the best thing a musician can do is leave the door open for God to walk into the room. And I think that's kind of that. Don't be too precious about anything that you're doing, whether it's words or music, because just give space and let it all happen.
You got to be there. Opportunity.
Right. But then the hard work is being there and ready to do the work. So you can't just sit there and wait for the something to hit you over the head either.
Yeah.
Usually.
You know, this whole process of songwriting and then sharing the songs with people and watching people really dig what you're doing, you know, that just touches you at the heart, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because if I just wanted to play music and it was just for me, I'd be sitting on my couch in my basement and I never record a thing. I never play anywhere. But to me, art is a lot like tennis. You playing on your own is not nearly the same thing as playing with an opponent on the other side, because every time you hit a ball over, it's coming back at you in a different, you know, in a different, different angle, a little harder, a little softer. And then it changes the way you hit the ball back over. And that's the way it is with an audience.
Yeah.
If you're playing, especially a live show, if you're making eye contact, you're making heart contact, you're reaching your audience. They're then reaching back to you, and it changes the way you then reach back out to them.
It really
does. And it's a symbiotic relationship that you're both having.
You know, I call it reciprocal. Gosh, I just had it. And I always call it
it is.
This.
I mean,
it's like a reciprocal energy. You know, you're I'm feeding you, you're feeding me kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it's that way. I mean, and when someone listens to a recording that you did, it's just a little different. I guess it's the difference between acting on a stage versus acting in a film. And that when you're doing that live show, it's instant. When you're doing something in film, you're waiting for that reaction. And sometimes it's a long time. You wait, maybe it's a year or two or 3 years later since you recorded something. Someone's coming back and saying, I just heard that song.
Yeah.
And this is what I feel. This is how I feel about it. And so it's just, it's different, but it still is the same sort of, hey, we just had a connection now. We've never met before, perhaps, mm-hmm. but you and I now share something that I don't share with 99% of human beings on this planet. Now you and I have this special thing. And if you can duplicate that over and over and over again, I think then you have become a successful artist. Whether it's right. sculpting or your painting, I've got a ways to go.
I just keep trying different things, and eventually, so it's something's going to connect with somebody.
And you know what though, Chris, you probably connected with people you just don't even realize. Though I think a lot of times, how many shows have you gone to in your life, or records that you listen to, and you never have an opportunity, or you never say something to that person, but they had a song that exactly. And so that probably has happened true. With you as well. You know, you just don't realize that you have connected with somebody, and it's weird to go up to somebody and say a song you wrote made me cry. Okay. Made me laugh.
It's very personal.
Yeah. It's very intimate, very personal, and not everyone is ready to go there yet. And so even you may have touched somebody, but they don't feel comfortable letting you know that you were able to do that, but it doesn't mean it didn't
happen.
I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. I would just keep that to myself and not tell them, be like, oh, I should tell them, but I don't want mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote a song after my sister passed away, and I wrote it with this guy named Ken Eby, and he used to sing it. And this guy came up to us after our set and said, you know, I just lost my sister, and that really touched me. You know, I was crying, mm-hmm. you know, and that felt, I grieved for him too, but mm-hmm. it just really felt, I felt something there.
Yeah, and that is tapping in to the tradition of songwriters.
Yeah.
Storytellers.
Yeah.
All artists are storytellers, even though not all of them use words.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But that is what you did right there. This is why we do what we do. Otherwise,
absolutely.
Like I said, we'd sit on a stool in our dark basements and never play in front of anyone if we didn't care.
And it's fun. I do like sitting in my basement playing for myself, but you know, it's not, you could do better. I could do mm-hmm. better.
I find that, you know, when I'm gearing my mind up for a performance, I tend to focus more on preparing myself. I might not always practice, but I'm gearing up, you know, for
you practice
for
in
that
your
experience.
Mind. Is that
in a sense I do, you know, and even when we get together with whatever configuration of group we're in, whether it's a duo, trio, quartet, whatever, you know, it's much more fun when you have something coming up than when you're just jamming.
How do you stay motivated? Like, what do you even work on? And it is like back to the, what do I write? You know, well, we can play whatever we want. What do we want to play? I don't know, but you're right. You got a gig coming up. All right. Yeah. Now it gives it some urgency, you know, it gives it a little more of a point. And I guess I guess I was wondering too, you know, Steve, as you doing all the music, is it hard to stay motivated? Because that's a challenge I have when I'm working alone. But have you just done it for so long that, you know, it's no problem now? Or
I think when I get to the point where I'm ready to start recording, I'm very motivated. So when everything's put together and I'm ready to start putting in the work, I typically put all the work in pretty quickly. The last album I recorded in 6 weeks, the whole thing.
Nice.
The other albums I usually record between 6 and 8 weeks, and then I've had other musicians come in and play. Doug Bowen, who I mentioned, has played guitar. I've had this friend since I was 9, Emilio De Trapani, who came and played keyboards on the first album. So those were recorded over several months. But I think when I get going, I get going because I kind of start, it's like a, I start seeing, because when you start putting down tracks on a song, it starts taking on this whole other life and it gets exciting. Yeah. And then, yeah, you know, you kind of want to see it, because I've been playing it on acoustic for so long. Now I'm hearing this beat behind it. I'm hearing a bass line. I'm hearing these other sections.
It's exciting, oh, isn't it?
Right. Exactly. And so you're like, what's going to happen tomorrow? It's like you're reading a book, you know, what's the next chapter going to look like? So I tend to, when I get going, I'm very motivated because I get excited about having the album unfold, because a lot of it's still mysterious. Because a lot of it, like I said, is still kind of experimenting. I only know the words and the chord structures for sure. After that, I'm just interested to see what tomorrow's going to bring.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is exciting. I mean, you first start hearing this stuff recorded and you're like, wow, maybe that isn't so bad.
That first demo of a song, when you get a couple songs together and you throw them on your phone, or you throw them on, you know, whatever it is that you're throwing, you know, a CD, whatever it is you're throwing them, you're listening outside of your basement, you're in the car, you got headphones, walking through the park, and that first demo, and it's like you just gave birth to something. And it is, it might not be ready yet, like you were talking about, Chris. It's not ready.
Little time in the oven still.
But it is, you see, it's taking its first steps, and it's exciting to watch it take its first steps. And so that's my favorite part in the process.
Yeah, I feel you.
What happens when that baby is breech?
Yeah, well, it doesn't get on the album is what
it
happens.
Takes a little longer. Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, painful.
I have one song every album. Without fail. This happened when I was writing that album with Doug in Aberrant Way. It's happened on my three solo albums since, and there's always one song that nearly destroys me every time. That's the breach. Yes. And every time, that's the one that takes longer to mix. It takes longer to record. It takes longer to be happy with, you know, just there's one song every album that's the problem child. And without fail, it's never happened before where I didn't have one that took, I would say if you have a song, let's say it was 10 songs, where 9 songs take 20% of the time. And I swear to you, that 10th song takes 80%.
Mike and I, we just finished recording our third album. And it's so great. You know, we started like a year ago. We're like, this is amazing. We're going to be done in 3 months, because we started off playing all the songs that are just, they just roll off the tongue. You know, they write themselves and you record it and it sounds great. And then as we go on, we're getting to the songs that maybe aren't quite finished yet. And there's a reason in the last few. Oh, they're painful.
Especially that very last one.
The last song.
The last one isn't even really written hardly yet. We had some ideas.
Me, it tends to be the one that I like the best is the one that gives me the most, because I have an expectation of it. And that's the one that becomes the problem.
You're like, no, this could be better. I could do this better.
And it never lives up to those expectations that you've created, which, by the way, are ridiculous probably in the first place, because you're pretty darn sure that you just wrote the next, you know, whatever it might be, you know.
Yes. This is my huge hit. Yeah.
This is Hey Jude. And, you know, if only I could get the mix right.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the only thing holding it back from being Purple Rain is this.
You just tweak it a little bit. Just tweak it a little more and toss this in there. EQ.
One more vocal layer. Part here. Yep. Yeah. A seventh guitar.
It's a Streets with No Name, 105 layers on it.
Yep, exactly.
Oh my gosh.
How young were you when you started developing an interest in creating music?
I was pretty old, I think, by most people's standards. Okay. My first band that I'm going to use air quotes, no one will see. My first band that I joined, I was 19. I'd never played an instrument in my life, never sang, never did anything, but I was a janitor at a church. And there was this band that was getting ready to go on a mission trip. And I somehow got myself into playing with these people and singing with them. I have no idea how that happened. And I was 19 at the time. I'd never written a song, never did anything. And me and the bass player in this band just kind of clicked. And since I was the janitor, I had the keys to the building.
Oh, so yeah.
I had access to the sound system. So there every Wednesday night. We would be there till 2 in the morning, blaring music on these. We would, because he listened to music I didn't listen to. I listened to music he didn't listen to. We were constantly introducing each other. He was into like black metal and like, you know, it was, you know, Black Sabbath. It was these German bands that I never heard of. And then I'd play them
typical church music.
Yeah. And then no one was there. And so, but yeah, we were, so, you know, we kind of, we did put, you know, we just kind of continued on with that band, and they decided at some point, like, Steve doesn't know how to sing. So
that minor,
what we're going to do is nitpicking. We're going to break up and reform without him.
Oh,
classic.
Yep.
But the bass player in solidarity
this time.
Yeah. The bass player in solidarity quit that band too, because me and him kind of clicked anyway. And so we did our first baby steps. You know, I was 19, 20, 21. He was at 25, I think. And he just learned bass himself. So we were very much babies musically. Mm. And you guys probably remember what I'm about to say is the first songs we wrote and recorded were on cassettes. Where we
like
would
the
have
a little 8-track?
No, my friend. I'm talking about a boombox that you can record an overdub.
Yeah.
And then you overdub again, and that there's so much noise in the background.
Was it like a four track?
No. It's just a cassette tape. You're constantly overdubbing. So you have all this white noise. But amongst the white noise are these instruments that you're playing on songs that you wrote. And it was magic. I remember to this day, that first time we had enough songs to throw on a cassette tape. It was like 10 songs and we put them in a track listing.
Oh my gosh. real band.
It was amazing. Exactly. Oh, and that's so cool. That was my first. And when I did that, I thought this is amazing. I still don't know how to play an instrument at that point. I still can barely sing, but we were making sounds that kind of sounded like music. And that was enough for me. That was all I needed.
That is huge. It really is. I mean, that is the defining line between who is a musician and who is not. You know, you took the step. You're one of us now. Gooble gobble.
Yeah. And it's a passion. You were driven to mm-hmm. do that. Yeah.
And I wasn't even a big fan of music for a long time. I had a couple of cassette tapes as a kid. I had my Duran Duran and Beastie Boys Licensed to Ill and Thriller. Those are my first three cassettes, and I had that. But really, it wasn't until about I was probably 13 or 14 before I found a band that made me think music is really important. And that changed my world. And from then on, I still didn't think about being a musician, but I realized the importance that music had in this world.
Yeah.
And it got me kind of on the track.
What band was that?
That was U2. I saw a music video for Pride in the Name of Love. And I saw this band with mullets and these, you know, crazy, you know, I think Edge had a Rickenbacker. And so, you know, it's kind of cool looking, weird guitar looking. And it was just like, you know what? This just changed my life. And I didn't even realize exactly why yet, but I knew it was different now than I was before. And that was it for me. After that, it was like,
your life just changed.
It did. I realized what importance music had in this world, what art had in this world, and just how much I liked these bands and how much the music they made me feel either sad or happy. And I realized, well, this just unlocks something, and it and if it unlocks something in me, it unlocks something in other people. And all of a sudden I saw the world differently.
You know, it's like this music makes me feel something. And then you realize, you know what? I could make music that make other people feel something. It's like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It could happen.
It still boggles my mind. I still don't even know what it's because I've never quite experienced this, but what is it when you're in front of, let's say, 1,000 people and they start singing your song back to you? That's still,
oh my God.
The thought of that blows my mind to this day. What is that? You guys are having a communal, congregational, religious experience.
That's right.
Right here together. And wow, that's just it still blows my mind that that happens.
It'd be cool. How do you do that? Facebook? I don't know. Where do you get fans from?
Explain. You know, you can buy them, I think.
Yeah, I don't think I've played to 1,000 people in all of my shows total.
I think I was in a band that we played at like Arts Beats and Eats 1 year. And I think nice. There was 1,000 people that we could see.
Okay,
I don't know how many that paid attention to us, but right, we right. saw them.
Yeah, think about it, Mike. We just played at the Apple Umpkin Festival. And right. there were hundreds of people walking by.
Well, that's true. We
acting
touched a
like
few
they
ears.
Couldn't hear us, but I knew they could hear us.
Yeah,
I could tell. Yeah. They were pretending to ignore us, but
we touched
no.
their ears at some level.
I think that is the first thing you need to teach young musicians is that you are going to spend time writing music. You are going to put your heart and your soul into it. You're going to put hours and hours of rehearsal. You will make plans. You will get t-shirts made, and then you will have a show, and there will be 4 people there. And that happens to everyone. That happens to, that is Jeff Buckley used to play to 4 or 5 people in this little, you know, little bar cafe in Greenwich
New
Village.
York. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, just that is exactly how it goes. It doesn't matter who you are. That is how you start. You just don't start unless you're a K-pop band that's manufactured.
Yeah.
You're just not starting in front of an audience. You are, right. you are building your audience literally one person at a time. And I think every young, and when I say young, I don't mean by age. I just mean how many years you've been playing.
New musician. Yeah.
This is going to happen. And if that's going to dissuade you from ever playing again, let it dissuade you because that's probably not. I don't know why you're here at that point.
I've seen people have meltdowns because, you know, well, I mean, and I don't want to be negative about it. I get it when you're young and you've got all the dreams and your soul hasn't been crushed yet. Like, have you seen Tenacious D in The Pick of Destiny?
Yeah.
And there's the gig simulator. And it's like, yes, this is what the kids need to know is that, you know, he makes Jack Black play in front of a bunch of dummies that are booing and throwing things at him. And it's like, that is rock
and roll.
Wait a
minute. That's great that a lot of people show up, though, to boo you.
Right.
Well, my
right.
guess is maybe that's why they showed up at all, just to be mean. But yeah, it is a struggle, and I've seen this in everything. You know, I'm not a professional musician. I can't make enough money. I make more money making websites, and just I've worked with so many companies with products and marketing and whatever. And I'll tell you what, these companies, they have a product, like we have music as a product, and trying to get people to buy that product, it is just as painful. Luckily, they have like millions of dollars and whatever, and they can, you know, have more options for advertising. Mm-hmm. But what's cool now is that I think until recently, how do you advertise as a musician? You put up posters, you busk or something, you know, mm-hmm. you couldn't get onto the radio, but now we have social media. You can get followers and drive it down people's throats online.
Yeah.
Bieber get popular on YouTube?
Seems like it's a probably. Well, it's kind of a two-edged sword though, because we've democratized music to the point now there's so much out there it's really hard to break to kind of cut through. Like before it was like if you were reasonably good musician and you could outwork everyone because of not having social media. So you could, like you said, busking, flyers, just make yourself everywhere all the time by hard work. Just work harder than everyone. Your product can be okay, can be a B+, but you can work like an A+ and it gets you out there. But now, because of social media, it's just a lot easier to get your stuff out there. So now how do you cut through everyone? And that's I think that is the biggest difficulty. And I think that is why that's what you guys know. Excellent musicians who will never, never sell records. Okay. Except for they'll give a few away and they'll sell a few, and some people will stream their stuff and you've heard their work and you know it's good.
It's
but
great.
They'll just never quote unquote make it big or even medium to the point where they can quit their jobs because it's just, there's so much out there.
It is.
And it's free.
We're a needle in the haystack.
Yeah. And then get it for free. Why pay for it if you can get it for free?
Well, I think you could always get it for free because you had radio, you know, you just turn it on and you listen to what.
Yeah,
was
but you can't dial up a song or a band. Now you can. You basically have radio at your fingertips.
So how do you get them to dial you up? That's out of the millions of bands. You know, when I see how many bands are out there, it's like, this is more people than live on Earth. What is everyone in a couple of bands? It is just an ocean of music out there.
Hey, man, I'm in the side project and this other side project.
Mike has three bands.
All my projects are side projects.
They're all side projects.
I have a day job.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's true. How you cut through? I don't know how you cut through. I don't think you can make a plan unless you are willing to, unless you're 21 and you don't have a family to support. You don't have children. You are willing to be poor for a long time. You're willing to move anywhere in the world. And even then it doesn't, you're still one of thousands like you.
Yeah.
And so then it's, I think there's definitely a balance between dumb luck and skill and hard work. And there's a Venn diagram of all those things.
Yeah.
And you got to be right in the middle. You have to work harder than everyone else. You have to write pretty quality stuff. And then you have to be writing that quality stuff and working hard and accidentally have someone overhear you.
And be lucky. Yes.
Yeah. And be lucky. You got
to definitely try to be lucky if you have the option.
Better than being good most cases.
Yeah. But I do think there are things that you can do that like increase the odds. It's like, all right, you go out there and I want to be more popular and get fans. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a 0.01% chance of that happening. But then there's things you can do, it's a 0.1% chance. So by promoting yourself online or whatever. And there are people out there, like they get just a TikTok video or something like that, and suddenly, you know, it brings it in. And if they hadn't, most people with the TikTok videos don't get popular. But if they hadn't put it out there on one of these platforms, then they wouldn't have gotten popular either.
Yeah. Do you work at Costco? Go work at Costco in Nashville. You know, you got to put yourself in that. If you want, I mean, put yourself in that environment. If you're a barista here, go be a barista in New York. If you're a, you know, put yourself in the positions, because odds are, if you're living in Sheboygan, the odds of you catching on in front of people who can make it happen for you. But then again, what is success? Then you start to say, well, what is success to you? Is it being respected for being excellent at your craft? Is it playing in front of a lot of people? Is it making a lot of money? Is it, because there's various elements that, and what I'm saying could be construed as someone who's never going to make it. So I'm just, you know, it's like, well, you know, it's like, And I understand that, but I think it is serious though, because I have heard the stories about people who went off and made their big records in Nashville, but they had to cut this and change this and do this.
Right.
And it's like, they got that one record, and now it's like, well, they're still back right next door to me except with the horror story. So there's,
but you're making music from the heart. You're still an artist, you know, and neither of you are successful. So you win.
We all ended up in the same spot.
Right.
Exactly. Chris and I have kind of talked about wanting to have one fan, just one fan, one fan. That's not a friend, not family,
not another musician,
not another
either.
Musician.
Mm-hmm. Cause you know what? I love the music community. We all support each other. Like, you know, anybody I know, and if I were just a random person hearing their music, I wouldn't be their target market, but yeah. So what? I'm sure that's the case for me and everyone else, and you're supportive of each other, but it makes us not real fans. You know, I guess that's it. I would love to have us release something and have somebody who isn't a relative or another musician, like a real fan. I bet you have a few, Steve. Do you have a few real fans?
Occasionally someone, I'll get a message or somebody will come up to me somewhere at a music festival or something and that I've played at, who will say, I really dug your set, and I've never seen them and I'll never see them again. It happens occasionally, but going back to what you're saying, Chris, is don't dismiss musicians who like you, because If you are not a musician, you do not understand what it takes to write a song. You might think it's easy. You might think it pops out of nowhere. There is stuff that you, as a non-musician, you have no idea how difficult it is to write a song. So if a musician comes up to you and says, I like what you did, that's actually...
Oh, that's a huge compliment.
That is huge because
I don't want to be ungrateful. I appreciate it. But, we're war buddies, other musicians, we're all down there in the trenches trying to make it happen. And, another one to acknowledge you is great, but it's just a different perspective, I guess.
You're right. Right. I think you grab other musicians on a more of an intellectual level because they see it's very what you're doing there. On that song, in that bridge is very difficult. I couldn't do that. They're looking at you as an intellectual,
peer,
compatriot, peer,
fellow craftsman. That was, I really like your woodworking, show me your power tools, it is like anything.
But the fan is the one who cries when they hear what you just sang or performed because you reach them on a non-intellect, you reach them at a heart level. I totally understand that. And I do have occasionally people who will say something nice like that. And it is nice, even if, all it takes is one of those people and you're like, yeah, I'm good.
Exactly.
This show made coming out, packing my gear, showing up, setting up the gear, spending hours playing songs that you think no one's listening to anyway. And then you put it all away. All it takes is that one person.
And there's that one person.
I'm coming back. I'm going to do it again. I'm not going to stop.
And the general fan doesn't know how many hours it takes to put together a 3.5-minute song.
Yeah, I think Paul Simon said something along the lines of, as a musician, you could be the world's worst musician, and what you know about music dwarfs what 90% of the rest of the world know about music. You have a master's degree in music compared to most people on this earth as the worst musician. So just go from there. And you already have excelled at something that relatively very few people can at.
Yeah.
And it is. And that's another reason I love the musical community. And I love, I'm so, one of the best decisions I ever made was starting that online open mic back when lockdown started last year. Mm-hmm. And, I knew I couldn't do it by myself. I've already talked about my motivation problem. So I reach out to Chad and Dan Cowan. And they've been great. And just being able to once a week sit down with other musicians. And it is, we are all living in the same kind of thing. We're trying to write songs and we're trying to get people to hear them and get better and stay motivated and positive and whatever. And I love it. I love that kind of camaraderie. And it's great, but I guess I'm greedy and I do want one non-musician fan as my goal. So
I think that's good. I think that I still completely understand that because it's that difference between getting someone's head and getting someone's heart.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well said.
So I really don't know much about you. How do you spend your days when you're not doing music?
So I work for an insurance company.
Okay.
And I handle appeals, complaints. Basically, if you have a beef with us, I will review it.
And is it auto or health or
health home? Insurance?
Health insurance.
Okay. Yep. So
I could tell
a
you
large that, health insurance company. There you go.
Yes. The I worked. It was homeowners insurance, and the kind of complaints you get from them is not the same as you get from health insurance. It's a completely different animal.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of life and death stuff, and it's difficult because no one who calls an insurance company is calling because everything's going great.
Right.
No, they're not calling to tell you what a great job you've done.
No, no. So you've got literally life and death, people going through life and death situations, and you are the tip of the spear that they hate. And
you're the face of the mindless corporation.
Yeah. So I'm one of my, I'm one of the people that make sure we did a good job. And so it's kind of rough, but it pays the bills. It allows me to support, my half of the my half of the family, you know, my, you know, and allows me to play music and allows me to not worry about where my health insurance is coming from or where my paycheck is coming from. So it would be nice to, you know, and I think when we talk about, this is kind of an aside, but I think most people, this might be controversial what I'm going to say, but I think most musicians who want to be professional musicians, they just don't want to have to go to a 9-to-5 job. That's what it, because I have a job and that takes 40 plus hours a week. And yet I'm still able to write albums and work on music and play. And
I'm busy. Of your life left, even with a family, you know, that's a huge commitment too.
It is. You know, so would I not like to have to go to that job and just play music all day long? Sure. But I don't need to not have a job to be creative. And as a matter of fact, I believe you need to live life in order to have something to say in your music.
I agree.
You are going to produce very good music if all you do is music. People who music is life to them. And that's
what
all
are you
going
to write about?
Well, they pay people to write music for them.
Get some normal people with lives to write lyrics.
You need to have a Bruce Springsteen type life. You need to have, I think it was David Bowie after he got clean, when he was on the road touring, when he was in between shows, he would schedule like painting lessons, photography lessons. He would schedule stuff on the road because he didn't want to just be doing music. He wanted to live a life. He wanted to be creative in other ways. And that's how you stay out of trouble too.
Indeed. You know, yes.
By filling your life with things that you can put back into your music prevents you from having all that empty time. I think many musicians have said this. I just remember a quote from Michael Hutchence from NXS talking about how 2 hours a day was great. He didn't know what to do with the 22 hours other than that. And it was, it was just terrible.
Committing suicide.
He did. He committed suicide.
Yikes.
And so, you know, but so, I mean, and there were a bunch of other stuff going on, including, I believe he actually had a head injury a couple of years prior to that. He lost he lost his sense of smell and taste and then suffered depression. And studies have now come out in the last 20 years that actually talk about the rates of suicide when you lose a sense
from head injuries.
When you lose a sense, they increase every sense you lose. So you lose, ones that you've had your entire life and then you lose, you just increase your odds. So there was a lot of other things going on there, but it was very sad. But that being said, it's when all you have is the one thing, you have a lot of time to make mistakes.
Right.
And you don't have a lot to talk about, I don't think, in your songs, if you're not living life.
Yeah. I mean, and if your audiences are people who don't live like that, you know, how do you even stay in touch with them? I saw years back, I saw on the back of a van, and it was like the old style van that I would expect was full of music equipment. And a bumper sticker said, "Real musicians have day jobs." And that really stuck with me. I don't think a bumper sticker has ever affected me emotionally this way before, but I'm like, you know what? Maybe I am a real musician. And the more I thought about it, it is like having a day job is probably the best way to go to pursue music. And you listed some of the reasons. You stay in the world, you know, you're having experiences. And you've got money to buy all the damn equipment and stuff that you're going to need. And honestly, until you're massively successful, how much time do you really need?
Right.
You know, you could even go on tour. I suggested to Mike a few years ago. I don't think it'll ever happen. We'd take a week off and just, you know, plan a whole bunch of gigs and just drive down to Nashville or whatever, play a gig, come back.
Let me ask you a little tour. If the two of you didn't have day jobs, does that mean you're getting up every morning at 8 o'clock and playing your guitar all day long to practice?
No, probably just get drunk.
Yeah, you're probably going to be, doing something that's not, I mean, I like to think the older we get, the more we realize, all right, I don't have a day job because I'm successful. I'm playing 3 nights a week and that is enough to, you know, I'm X number of thousands of dollars per gig, 3 nights a week. That's now I'm making what I used to make. All right. Mm-hmm. And now I have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday free. Well, you could rehearse, but also read something. Also go take a class in something, put yourself in the world, because rehearsing is just
arts.
About
you could you march, could take martial
whatever
arts.
You want, because rehearsing music and rehearsing your and perfecting your art form is not all about playing your instrument. Right. It's about filling yourself with the world so that you can now pour that back out again through whatever scope you're using that makes you a significant and a unique artist, something a way that you can never do or no one else can do like you.
I thought it was just about playing the scales really fast.
Huh. And the chicks are great.
Yes. Oh, yeah. All
Steve,
the babes.
I mean, you certainly shared a lot of wisdom in that statement. And, you know, life needs to be more than one thing. You know, I've worked with people who've retired and they have nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, all they ever did was work and that's it. You know, no matter what you're doing, it's important to have more than one thing, because when you lose that one thing or that one thing's not available, then what do you do?
Over the last year and a half, I can't tell you how many times I've heard musicians freaking out because they can't play. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it's a bummer, but go out and build yourself up with other things. That way you're going to be twice the musician, not because you can play scales faster, but because you have more wisdom and you've pulled in more into yourself, into your soul.
You've had more life.
More life. Absolutely.
I don't know. Yeah. I felt like I've really grown because, I mean, it is more time to write and record. And so many people are doing things online now, streaming, concerts,
therapy.
Yes. Go to therapy. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know. I hate playing out. All right. I'm making a confession. It's so much work.
It's
usually it is there's a couple people there who aren't listening. And it is hard to get myself motivated. And I do have to admit that I have been enjoying pretending like I don't have to because of the lockdown. But you know, that's ending soon, I guess. People are kind of going back to normal. Are you are you planning any gigs out?
He's got one coming up this weekend.
I've got one tomorrow at the Proving Grounds in Royal Oak.
From 1 to 3.
From 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock tomorrow, and then I'm playing. Mm-hmm, and then I'm playing as a featured artist. There's a new open mic, a live human in person open mic at Lockhart's in Royal Oak on Fridays.
The barbecue place.
Yeah. And so on November,
I love that place.
On November 12th, I'll be the featured artist. I'll go on at 9:15 p.m. and I'll probably play for 45 minutes or an hour. The open mic is before that. And then the featured artist goes on. So basically I have carte blanche. I can just play as long as I want. So that is on the 12th, November 12th, Friday, the November 12th. And then that's pretty much what I have for the year, though.
Right. Well, that's pretty good. I didn't know. I didn't even know Lockhart's ever had an open mic.
It's starting a week from today. Will be the first night on the 5th.
Oh man, I might have to go try a real open mic.
You should. I don't know how. I mean, Friday night open mics are difficult. I don't know. I don't know how long. You know, that's just a tough gig. But
it's
see how it goes.
Night. It's a gig night for a lot of musicians.
Exactly. And so, but because they do the featured artist, I think they're going to get some of those.
Yes. Yeah. Cause it is like a gig. And you know, what's nice about headlining an open mic is you're guaranteed an audience because at least people came in to play a song before you got there. At least you have other musicians to play for.
And at bars on a Friday, you're going to have people that are going to be there at least to have a drink. And maybe you can make the best part. And you guys might be able to kind of go along with this too. The best part about a gig at a place like a bar is when you have people who have their back towards you and you sing one particular song and they turn around.
Yeah.
And he's like, I got him. That's the one that I got him. And then maybe later on somebody else does it. And he's like, I got them. And that's who you're playing for, is those people that you can get, if it's for one song, to turn their back away from the bar, look at what you're doing on stage, because you've been able to connect in some way. Exactly.
And that's reel them in.
Every show I play, it is that sort of That's what I'm trying to do. I'm making eye contact, and I'm doing my very best to connect with anyone I can connect with. And if I can come away with a few of them, I feel pretty good about it.
I don't know if you know who Mike Gentry is, or if you listen to his podcast that he did with us, but he works the crowd before the show starts.
Mm-hmm.
He introduces himself to audience members, and you know, he connects with the baristas and
he's very social.
And
I need to work on that. I'm not that social. That's pretty good. That's
you
pretty
try
good,
to
though.
Connect through your music and not through talking to people.
I can do that sometimes. I just have to be really on to do that. But there are some days I just don't have the energy, and I'm just, all right, come on, let's play.
That's true. I think of myself as more extroverted than introverted, but there's also that sense of like, and I don't mean this in a negative way. Some people are, I think this is a positive. I think everyone should have self-importance. Mm-hmm. Because everyone, I think, should say and should believe I've got something to bring to a conversation. I don't know that I don't always feel that way. When I'm feeling good about things, I do feel that way, but I don't always feel that way. I gotta work into that.
And you know, when you have a gig, it's scheduled. You have to force yourself to feel that way. And that's the trick. You know?
That's where the job part comes in. That's where this becomes a job. When we were in the band, we were playing 4 hours a night at these bars. That was a physical job. You didn't get paid a whole lot for it. Especially if you're the front person and
it's
exhausting. You feel like I need to do that. That is an exhausting job. And, you know, especially when you're playing for 4 hours, you play a lot of covers. You start just feeling like a jukebox after a while. And, you know, you're no longer, it's not just about these songs that you put your blood, sweat and tears in. You're also playing these songs you think that people are going to want to listen to. And you get away from what you really want to play. And some of those songs can be a lot of fun, but 4 hours is like,
I played in covers bands for years, and it is 4 hours. It is brutal. It's really, it's exhausting. And I liked it. I still like it, but I don't know if I like it enough. And between the thing is, you know, what's worse about playing covers is not playing them. It is arguing with your bandmates about which ones you should play. Because let me tell you, I've never been in a band where at least everybody didn't have an opinion on these are the songs that we should play that everyone wants to hear, and your songs are stupid. I don't miss that.
It is so funny that the band that I was in, though, the Aberrant Way, it was perfect. We never argued. We always came together on the songs we were going to play. It was, the camaraderie was amazing. The egos weren't there.
Of course, you were only together for 4 months, right?
We were together for about 16 months. That entire run from beginning to end, there was never any issue. We all just, I guess it was just the particular, mixture of the personalities. And it just kind of came out. Everyone just really enjoyed themselves. But I mean, I've heard the horror stories. I just never have had them, but I've heard them.
Well, you know, maybe it's just me. You know, they say the common denominator between all your bad relationships is you. But honestly, it is. I will take a lot of responsibility for that, because I don't like, when I'm in a band, I really like egalitarian groups. Like if I get into a group and there's one person in charge and everybody does what they say, I just quit. I won't be part of that. I like to be part of the chaos. I like to have four guys, and they all have ideas, and you're trying to find common ground and whatever. And I've seen bands, I mean, maybe that's how it worked with you, is you and Doug. Is that what you said? You guys had a certain chemistry, like a, you know, Glenn Frey, Don Henley kind of thing. And then the bassist and drummer just had to do what they took.
That's probably about right. But I think the thing is, as long as everyone in a band knows their particular role and likes their role, because I've been in a band where I just played what I was told to play, but I went in knowing that, and I just enjoyed playing gigs because I also didn't have to write any music. I just played the show. I had a couple drinks. I played the songs. I enjoyed the evening. I never had to chase anyone down for money because I wasn't in charge. So I've been in that role and I liked that role.
But then I've also been in the role. I love sitting in for a band. We'll do that too. Oh, our guitarist isn't going to be here and show up, learn the songs real quick, get some quick cash and get out. No, it is nice, but you know, you don't want to do that forever.
No,
it's not that satisfying.
There's seasons of life for these things. And I was in as a hired gun basically. And then I was in as a co-founder and I really enjoyed that. Now I'm doing things on my own and I'm really enjoying this. So I think that there's always just a season for all those artistic endeavors. And when you've said what you wanted to say, time to move on.
I've been in two bands for longer than Chris and I have had this combo. No Conflict and the Mighty Rhythm Bandits. And, you know, I play percussion and do some singing, but it's not just me. And I like that. We play some of my originals and then we play covers that the other guys like, and we just get along, and it's a pretty enjoyable outing, you know. Mm-hmm. and the idea of collaborating, you know, you're having a conversation with people through music, and I'm talking about your bandmates. You're having a conversation with them and you're talking to each other and you're listening to each other, you know, through the music, and when that works, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. Yeah, there's I remember this one particular show that we were playing with Aberrant Way, and I wasn't even singing on the song. I think I was just playing back like acoustic guitar. Doug was singing on it, and it was a Bruce Springsteen song called Born to Run. And there's this section that you guys probably know. It's an instrumental in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's got this amazing rhythm.
Glissando.
You have to be so tight. And just watching Doug and our drummer at the time and the bass player, I'm out to the side watching them in sync, lined up, eyes connected, music connected, and it's boom, da boom, da boom, da boom, 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 boom. And it's like, I was so happy. I was off to the side of just playing playing rhythm guitar and being able to be a fan of them linked musically. And it was just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It is true. And that is, you know, it isn't just we're talking about how it's social. There's this reciprocal energy with the crowd, but with the band too, being able to click and to make music with other people. It is a magical experience.
It is easier to be a solo musician, but there is a magic in being part of a gang on a stage, walking into the venue, setting your stuff up, putting it together, and then linked together in that magic. That is there's just something about that that you'll never do on your own, I don't think.
Right. It is. I do like it a lot. It's just, it's a lot more equipment. I think that's really
Yes, absolutely.
You know, when you're doing an acoustic gig, it is, man, it is so clean and simple.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a drummer. Talk about tons of equipment.
But we got for us, he just brings his little plastic drum kit that hangs around his neck. And
it's more than just a plastic drum set. It's a Zen drum.
Yeah. But that's the thing, is it really isn't any different handling than an electric guitar. He just plugs into the PA and off we go.
Mm-hmm.
And it is nice. Yeah. I should have gotten a smaller PA though. I overdid it a little on the PA, but you know what you're gonna do. So what are you working on musically right now? Are you starting a new project or
I start probably about a month and a half ago. I wanted, after the first three albums, I kind of felt like I finished a cycle. And I wanted to write the whatever I'm going to do next, I wanted to write differently. So I'm doing a little bit of, I'm kind of that magic I found when working with Doug in our previous band. I'm trying to reproduce that a little bit in that I'm writing. So I'm basically start with this. I'm starting with this whole set of files in my phone of chord progressions with
your ideas bucket
with melodies and basically just nonsense lyrics. Okay.
Right.
Coming up with the melodies and then when I feel like I've got a song, then I'll throw it in my demo tracks and I'll go on to the next one. And then what I plan on doing is actually finishing all the music on the album without doing one word, and then coming back and writing all the lyrics so that A, I can be in those boxes that constrict you, but also force you to be creative. But at the same time, I'm hoping for a lot of cohesion in the lyrics too. I'm a big fan of albums. Single songs. I love albums. I love not necessarily where every, not like concept albums or rock operas necessarily,
but collection albums, of the music, collection, you know,
absolutely. Where they do tell a story, a loose story, but they tell a story. They're cohesive. And so
it's more than just a collection of songs. The album is itself a piece of art.
I want it to be there to be an experience when you lay in your bed at night with the lights off and you put your headphones on and you listen to the first song and you let it go all the way to the last song. I want you to go on a trip of some sort. And so, it's important to me to have this cohesion. So I'm going to do all the music before with just these ideas of themes, but never even writing the music or never writing the lyrics. And then when I'm done, go back in and write the whole album from a lyrical standpoint, hoping to kind of recreate something and put myself, like I said, in boxes to force the creativity. I just want to see what happens, basically, because I wrote the first three where it was basically, you know, I've got some words, I've got a melody, I'm going to work that out, then I'm going to put it over music.
And you kind just develop that.
Basically singer-songwriter craft, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so I want to force myself to write in a different way. And so, about a month ago, I started in earnest and I've got probably 9-10 ideas. Great. And so I'm hoping to start recording around December or January. And then per my usual, have something up for next fall. I usually put stuff out in the springtime, but I want to write in the wintertime at a darker time of year. I want to see what that does to my writing too. Because usually I've done it in the springtime when it's, you know, the birds are chirping and the grass is getting greener.
Positive.
I want to see what happens in November and December writing lyrics, just to see how that changes, if it changes. It's just kind of experimentation in the way I'm going about doing
things. That's a good exercise.
Yeah.
I was listening to an interview with Genesis and they were talking about how they create the music first and then the words come along. And I think that was more the later Genesis.
The Phil Collins.
Particularly around the Abacab time.
Yeah.
Is when they were good really
album.
Doing
it. I really dug that album.
Yeah. And they came up with Abacab, and because those are the chords in the song.
That was the song structure was, ABA, the bridge, AB, there you go. And, but there's such a, progressive rock. I mean, and that's, you know, you're talking about how U2 influenced you, and I can hear it so much in your music. I mean, you've got these really great melodies and really powerful vocals and kind of a blues rock kind of thing. Unfortunately, I mean, I think for me, the first thing that really touched me was Prague, like Rush or something, which is now it has ruined me. I can't write songs that people like now because I want to be Rush. And, you know, you can't, Rush can be, they can get away with it. Nobody else can. Yeah. And these bands like Genesis or, you know,
King Crimson.
Exactly. These were primarily instrumentalists. I mean, these are almost jazz musicians. And I think they threw the lyrics on just to make it popular, just to get it on the radio.
I think some of them didn't care about popularity.
Well, I think they cared about popularity, but I think it was from an instrumental point. I mean,
their labels cared about popularity.
Oh, yeah. And like John Anderson from Yes, you listen to his stuff and those lyrics don't mean nothing. You know, they sound cool. There are a lot of words that sound neat, but you can kind of feel that. And Zeppelin did this too, where, you know, Jimmy Page would pretty much write the songs and then Robert Plant would have to figure something out. He'd just make it up on the spot.
Yeah, he would.
You know, that's kind of where I'm steeped. And it's given me a bit of a struggle where, you know, writing things the lyrics are an afterthought and the melody is interesting, but you know, not as interesting as the chords. And that is a very musician way to think and not a very audience way to think. Mm-hmm. And it's, that is my burden to bear. I was ruined by prog rock.
However, my experience with prog rock was different. You know, I loved, you know, anything from Frank Zappa to King Crimson to, you know, all those dudes, you know, Pink Floyd, Rush.
Oh, and, I love Floyd.
You know, it twisted my lyric writing to such a point where some of the stuff that I write is downright strange. I don't know if you guys have noticed
some
that.
Of it. all I see you write is "I love you, baby, doop a doop a doop." You know, that's
hold my hands, my hold quiz. My hands.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean
I love
maybe.
You. I love you, but you don't love me.
A classic.
I can't believe you broke my heart. You broke it pretty bad. I can't believe you broke my heart.
I think we just wrote a country song.
Oh my gosh.
I'm writing this down.
I've got it recorded. Yeah. Honestly, our last podcast was with Candy, and it is funny. Like, it's the same thing happened. I ended up taking notes. We were talking about, you don't know what you don't know. And we're like, oh, that's a chorus. I have it in my notes. I'm going to go back and see if I can flesh that out. And now we have, you know, the, yes, you broke my heart, baby. Why'd you break it so bad? There you go. Pretty much writes itself.
You're my favorite person that I've never met.
See, that is a Mike lyric. He starts to write something that was Waiting on a Heartbreak. Yeah. And, you know, with this album we're finishing up now, it was really an attempt to try to do something less ridiculous. You know, kind of we're just sort of doing straightforward. I like the term Americana. Mm-hmm. To me, Americana is like retro country. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like country from back in the day when country was cool. You know, Dolly Parton and oh, gosh. There's so many people I can't.
Yeah, I think of really I kind of think
Johnny
of like
Cash. I love
Emmylou
Johnny
Harris
Cash.
To a point too.
She's so good.
Yeah, yeah. I think there are some really good modern Americana artists. I think Jason Isbell is very good.
I love him.
I like Ryan Adams. I like guy I just discovered. I just discovered him, but he's been around for Rustin Kelly.
I've not heard him.
Yes, you know, Rustin Kelly is very
Christopher,
good. I just came across him.
Christopher Stapleton is just amazing.
I have not heard him.
I'm only slightly familiar with Chris. I love Brandi Carlile.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she's great.
Everything she touches
she was
is
just
amazing.
On Saturday Night Live.
She was.
She killed it. I watched it. It was
Me
great.
Too.
I haven't
she's
seen
just,
it yet.
She's just excellent. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I say the point of the going down the Americana tunnel is that, you know, I think Mike and I, we had been doing really eclectic stuff and we made this album, which actually has a consistent genre. And it was like what you're saying. All right, now you're giving yourself limitation. Mm-hmm. And it was glorious. And it is one of those things that when you give yourself limitations, you still are you. You know, yeah. It's like yeah. you're never like you. It's hard to sell out 100%. And, you know, Mike just writes, and this has happened on almost all the songs. He wrote this Waiting on a Heartbreak, which was probably the flagship song mm-hmm. where we got started. And it is real. I'm waiting on a heartbreak when
From
I found
a girl
you.
Like you.
Yeah, yeah. exactly. But then he throws in these little things about you're my favorite person that I've never met. That is a line from it that is hilarious. And you just don't even realize it on first. And there's all these little clever things. Like we wrote the two-stepping girl. She two-stepped away, you know, but then it's ridiculous. I mean, everything is super. Other than that, it starts to get really, really creative. But you're creative in these lanes that you've created for yourself. Exactly. Here's the boundaries. But man, even with those boundaries, you can do so much. You can really do it your own way. And I've been loving it.
And make it sound like you, Steve.
Well, yeah. And I think it's the kind of the difference between writing in prose and writing mm-hmm. poetry
yeah.
is that in prose, you can take a long time to spell something out. And it's far easier than only having stanzas of four lines. You got to be very, very yes. concise you have to be very talented with words to be able to say, give these very big emotions and these big thoughts in 4-line stanzas or 8-line stanzas or haiku, yep, whatever it is that you write in. That's why I think the beauty, the elegance, but also the challenge of poetry versus writing in other forms, because when you have pages and pages and pages and you don't have rules, you have a lot of fluff, and also you just, it's easier. And I think songwriting at its best is the ability to take big ideas and make them small enough for you to get inside your ears. And so, you know, I think that's why these walls
engineering, you know, yeah, you got to make it aerodynamic. You know?
You're painting a mental image and a story that people can relate to, or, I mean, mm-hmm, other lyricists do that. I'm not sure that I do, but.
Well, it's still your goal. I mean, I don't think there's any lyricist that.
Well, Surf Zombie.
All, I mean, well, that is a
mess. That's a picture. That's a picture. That's my head.
Clearly, it's definitely a Plants versus Zombies zombie is what I picture in my head when I think of
on a surfboard.
Zombie. Yeah, exactly.
What more needs to be said?
Nothing.
Two words.
It's like zombie moans, I think, is really.
You know, you can paint a picture in two words, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I totally buy into that you don't need a lot of words to be able to say a lot, I guess you can say.
Right.
Right. You know, I told you I've been trying to work on just writing songs on my own. I like that. I think I'm gonna, next time I get around to it. Do you ever like struggle? Like you said, well, your last three albums, you start off with a theme, you have a little melody and a lyric or something, and you develop it. Do you find yourself getting stuck on, oh, I need another verse. I don't even know where to start with verse two. Or because that's where I get. I'm like, I get a great idea for a chorus, and I'm like, yeah, in the first verse, and then it's just like, well, I'm out of ideas.
I think all the time. just to answer, yeah, the first thought is yeah, all the time. I typically, it's funny when I kind of get this turn of phrase or this idea, I'll set out a piece of paper. And I'll put little dots, and each dot represents a line. And I think I need 16 lines for this song.
Right.
This kind of goes here. This goes here. And I've got a lot of blank space in between. How do I connect the blank spaces in between? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't have just one way of songwriting, but that's definitely something I do quite a bit is, you know, sometimes it just flows from top to bottom. But other times it's, I've got this phrase. I like it. I've got this other thing. I think they're related, but they don't go next to each other. So how do I build a bridge from one to the other? Yeah. And that's how the song starts
all
getting constructed.
All those blank spaces just sitting there staring at you.
Yep. These little dots.
Some of the old songwriters, you know, from the Beatles to the Kinks to Elvis and some of the people that wrote for him, two verses, catchy chorus, repeat either the first or the second verse, good to go.
I could never understand that as a lyricist. Why would you give up all that space where you could be saying more things?
Well, if you're me and writing lyrics is like pulling teeth, maybe that's a life preserver I'm getting through. Just repeat the first verse. What are you doing, Broski? Come on. Why hurt yourself? First
you
verse
know, and
is
you have
fine.
You have the perfect 2.5-minute song.
You do?
Yeah.
I think it was what Billy Joel and the Entertainer said, you got to get down to 3:05.
Right.
Otherwise, they won't put you on the radio.
Right.
Well, I guess too, you know, they had 45s back then. I think it's all you could fit on one side of a small piece of vinyl.
And I think more than that even they just thought people didn't have that kind of wherewithal and bandwidth to listen to a song for more than 2 minutes and 50 seconds or 3 minutes on the radio because they need to get advertising X number of advertisements per hour.
You know, if you're pushing your song for radio, I mean, their currency is time. They have so much time they have to fill. And if you can give them a short song, it's going to be a lot easier sell than giving them In a Gata de Vida, which, you know, was still great, but really the exception other than the rule. Right.
You're not going to listen to tunes like Alice's Restaurant all the time.
But even then they would do like the radio edit. You do that a little. You have a full
The radio
song.
Edit is the worst thing that's ever happened to music.
You know, it just always made me, you're right. Like, I'd hear a song on the radio and I like it. I ended up getting the album and it's like, there's way more to this song. I had no idea.
Why did they do that?
As
a songwriter, could you ever imagine spending months and months and months getting these words just right to tell this particular story? And then somebody comes and says, I don't think we need it.
Oh my gosh. and this is, you know, we are the producers. There ain't nobody going to tell us. I mean, nobody's going to listen to our music either, but at least it's ours. You
That's
know?
One of the benefits of making it small in music.
Still so
absolutely. Small. It's still so small, but it's yours. But it's yours. Like you said, it is what you put out there is what you want to put out there. You can't, you know, if you will never be able to blame somebody else because they messed with your vision. Like, you are on the hook for all the good stuff and the bad stuff too.
It's all your own fault.
Yep, it is.
It is. I love being an adult. Pretty much all my problems are the result of my own terrible decisions. And that's how I like it. But it was, you know, I told you, I just watched this Jewel podcast. And she is so grounded. She was talking about her goal was just to be an artist. That was like what her focus, no matter what happened, it was about her artistry. And that served her so well. Now she ended up getting huge, you know, massively successful. Though her mother stole all her money was a story, but yeah. And it's just like, she really had an attitude, like making it small. Like she was, no, I'm writing my own music, my own way, whatever I want. She didn't compromise for nothing. And it's like, well, maybe it isn't just a side effect of not being popular. Maybe it's really a healthy way to be for all musicians.
Yeah, right? You listen to her first album was Pieces of You. And if you listen to that album, there's one or two songs that sound just very well produced. But then the rest of it just feels like, this is just the way she wanted it. It's not great for the radio. There's a song she called the song on that first album called Adrian, I believe it is. That's just this sad song about this kid who got picked on in school. And it was like, you could tell this was something Jewel wanted to put out there. It wasn't going to be big on the radio. It wasn't going to be like a happy day, but it's like, she didn't care. You know,
the record label was not begging for this song.
No. Give us more Who Will Save Your Soul.
Just do that again.
Yeah, the kids like that.
The Nickelback route. Just put some different lyrics to it. Make it the same song.
Or, you know, like Chuck Berry did. You know, you just use the same music track and add and put different words over top of it.
Yeah, that's true. I get to a point, I guess. Well, I mean, with a lot of those blues musicians, too, it wasn't necessarily the chord structure was the chord structure every time. And it wasn't about that, though. It was about what you were saying with the way you said it, you know, not so much the chord structure, because it was more about the performance of it.
Right.
More than just, you know, some chords and what notes are you playing. To them, it was, what story am I telling with the voice, with the instrument?
And then that's the good theme. Good morning, little schoolgirl. Profound.
Well, it's not about
in a creepy way.
It's about about the emotion. Yeah. Hey, well, and your target market. You know, if you want teenagers to buy your stuff,
right?
But I do think it goes back to that same theme about, you know, limiting yourself, putting in. It's like, okay, with blues and early rock and whatever, you do not get creative with the chords and the chord progressions.
Right.
That is set. That is fixed. Now, what can you do with that? And a lot of it is soloing and just the energy. It's so much about the performance. It blues really is a performative art form. And that's what it is. And then I think you see a lot of these things when you go to a genre, they do have certain things are set in stone. Now, this is how you play the genre. That's not very limiting. There's still so much you can do with it.
Yeah.
But
that's why it keeps getting made. We haven't run out of blues music. You're still going to hear guys like Kenny Wayne Shepherd still shake it up a little bit. And you know, we have 80 years of this and we still have Johnny Lang. We still have all those guys, those new guys still doing it.
Yeah. I do think it's because it really is blues is meant to be played live.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. that it is very flexible. It is very responsive to the audience, and you know, anybody can sit in. That's a beauty of it, because it is the chord progressions are so standard. Mm-hmm. You could just walk into a blues band and you would be able to play the song without even knowing what they were playing. You'd have to figure out the key, but after that, you're pretty much, you know, you're good to go. And that is what makes it so great for improvisation and for the social. I don't like it. I'm a terrible improviser. It stresses me out. I'm like, wouldn't this sound better if I sat down and worked on it for a while? No, you're not a good blues player, Broski. Stop it. That's not how it goes.
Well, with the name of Memphis Hawk, one would assume you would be a blues player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see how you could see that, or at least country. And I'm really not particularly one way or the other. Like I said, I think I like the spiritual side of the blues player, but yeah, the instrumentation, while I appreciate blues, I've never played it. It's never been something that I don't even listen to a lot of blues. I listen to jazz, but not really a lot of blues music though. I do appreciate some of those art. John Lee Hooker, I really liked. Albert King, I liked.
Oh yeah.
B.B. King. So, I mean,
of course.
Yeah. I like Eric Clapton's later work when he started doing more of the blues stuff. I really enjoyed. So I do like blues music. It just isn't it's not something I feel being creative with. I feel that's for other people to do.
Yeah. Well, my experience of you musically is that you're pretty middle of the road folk guy, folk Americana.
Really? I'm hearing rock. It's very almost. Yeah, it is blues rock. Now you talked about U2, I hear that a lot. And even though they're an Irish band, I mean, you know, so influenced by American music and rock and roll and whatever.
U2 was Americana.
And it goes back and forth, you know, back and forth across the pond.
Well, I think it differs too, whether I'm doing it acoustically or whether I'm doing it in a kind of a full band setting too, is it sounds different. I can see more of the Americana when it's just me and a guitar, because I am picking up on more of that performance nature of it, because when it's just you and a guitar, and I'm not the greatest guitar player, so I've got to do different things to be interesting.
Right.
In which case, maybe I'm doing something different with my voice, being louder and softer, changing up a bit, keeping the pace changing, which then sounds more bluesy because I'm doing more with my voice, where on a record, the voice is just part of what's going on. It's all a little more spaced out, but definitely in a live setting, it does probably go into more of that folk or Americana or blues depending, but that's just because I think the nature of playing acoustically.
Mike's probably, that's how he's most familiar. I went through and I listened to your albums, and it really is. Mike, if you haven't had a listen to them, I definitely recommend it. Yeah. You know, we don't get paid for this, so. But I think you will really enjoy it, and I am a fan, which is one reason why, you know, we have so many people we want to be on here, and it's like, who's next? It's like, I want to talk to Memphis Hawk. I love his music, and I don't know anything about him, and you know, I'm going to keep it that way. Let's come on, let's talk, let's get to know each other. And I was really looking forward to this, and man, it's been great so far. We can keep going. We can go as long as you want.
But, you know, I probably have to probably maybe just another 10 minutes or so. I need to be somewhere in a little while, but I've loved this. And anytime you guys want to talk about music,
you're the
we'll can do that. This is the right. You got like we had someone bail on us. Let's talk to Memphis because I will jump on, because there's just, I mean, I love talking about art and being creative and music, and I you know there's so much stuff out there. Just we could spend an hour just on the craft of songwriting,
right?
You know, and all three of our different. There's just so much to talk about.
Though, I think I'd have to bring my guitar out, and you could bring your guitar out, and then
play
songs
for each other.
Where it leads, you know. That's like, well, what do you think about this? Where would you go with this? Next thing you know, you've accidentally written a song. So, I guess as when we go to wrap it up, is I've really been enjoying asking people about the other musicians that you work with, and that you want to give them a shout out. who do you want to give a little time to?
Well, I think I mentioned Doug Bowen, fantastic songwriter. He's a machine. If you think I'm prolific, Doug Bowen will write 30 songs and then say, I like five of them. I'm going to now dump the other 25 and write 30 more to get five more. So
I wish I could do that.
Yeah. But other than that, though, pardon me?
Did you mention
Matthew Schmidt? Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Emma Guzman?
No.
She is 19 years old. I've been watching her play since she was 11. She is just a phenomenal. She's been writing songs forever. She's amazing. Abby Tipton. Are you familiar with Abby?
Abby's no. Music at all?
Abby Tipton. Phenomenal voice. Plays piano. Plays guitar. She's a treat if you can ever see her live. I've got a couple bands actually I was thinking of. There's so few bands, we know so many individual artists.
Right.
This band called Pure Nonsense just put out fantastic record called Tonight. I suggest you go check it out. It is just a great rock and roll album. It is just a fantastic straight ahead rock and roll album. It's just really, really, really solid stuff. This other band called Avatar Mode, who I only came across at open mics. They just got into the studio. They're in the studio right now putting together their first album, Avatar Mode. I think they're going to be, I just really like them. They're actually all cousins. So you really feel this camaraderie in the band.
Oh, nice. like the Osmond family. All right.
Yeah. And then Tom Alter, of course.
Yeah, of course.
I love Tom. And then you guys know Mike Ward.
I know of him.
Mike Ward. Okay. Yeah. He's fantastic too. Those are the first ones that kind of came to mind when I was thinking like, you know, who am I really into right this minute? You know, those are the ones that definitely jumped to mind, though.
Cool.
Well, I got confirmation on our next guests. And
are we breaking news right now?
Well, I did that in the beginning of our conversation here, as I sent out a message and I got a response. And you were going to be talking to just this couple by the name of Adam LeBeau and Sarah Gibson next
month. Awesome.
Right. Do you know those guys?
Steve? I do not. I will when they do their interview, though, and I'll listen to it. And then I'll feel like I know them.
Adam's a great singer-songwriter. And
I don't think heard him, but he does that rocking for stockings thing.
Yeah, yeah. But I've seen some videos where he and his whole family actually did a cover of a Mike Gentry song.
Really?
And it was very cool. And Sarah Gibson, she is on... probably on Mike Ward's album, and she
plays cello
on so many different records. So I'm kind of excited to have those folks join
absolutely
us.
And then it'll be my job to dig somebody up for December, and my goal is we should have we'll line people up for the next 6 months, and we'll give people a little more heads up now that we know that people like the podcast.
People
see you guys
like
know
it.
I think you guys have done a really good job. I think this is fantastic. I was thinking to myself maybe a year ago how great it would be to listen to a podcast with local musicians that you either know or that you've run across or that you want to run across.
Right.
Because
we should
of
do that.
People you hear about.
We should do that sometime.
That is, I guess we have to start taking this seriously now, Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just kind of like podcast. How hard can it be? You get on, you talk for a few hours and then ship it.
Well,
I'm
and
doing
you
that
know, the
anyway.
Way I look at the way I look at it is we're just having a conversation with a peer, a buddy, a pal, a cohort.
Part of the community. I mean,
thesaurus. What else can we say?
Music? And I think musicians ask the best questions of other musicians for the most part, because I think that you pull stuff out that other people, a listener sees the top of the iceberg, but I think other musicians see everything below that. So not that non-musicians don't also ask a good, they're just different. And I think that
questions.
This is a right. It's stuff that you may not consider as someone who also writes songs. So I appreciate the questions.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I hope that our audience is, not just musicians, but maybe mm-hmm. people who are thinking about becoming mm-hmm. musicians. Mm-hmm. And that I would love it. You know, if somebody's like, oh, I'm never going to make it, you know, I'll mm-hmm. fail. There's so many musicians out there. It's a waste of time. It's like, no, most of the musicians out there are like us and we love it. This is not this is not failure.
No.
This is success. And it's a great part of my life. And the community and the art and everything. And I'm never going to stop. You say, you know, a guy who people who retire and don't have anything to do, we will never have that problem.
Yeah. You know, and people at our level, we kind of do things as a passion, not as an income. You know, like Chris and I joked about how, you know, during the pandemic, we saved so much money by not gigging. Yeah,
just gas money alone.
Not wrong. Some passion. But,
awesome.
Hey, it's been great getting to know you, Steve. You know, now I think you're kind of a nice guy.
You know what? After the 2 hour mark, it's you know, it may have gone the other way. So luckily, Mike, we got to 2 hours. If it was 2:05, you might see some ugly stuff. So
then it, cut it off. That's what I live for.
Don't feed me after midnight. That's all.
And don't dunk you in a pool of water.